it's good to look both ways before you close the door.
All right. Ladies and gentlemen, we're going to finish up the last little bit of information that's going to be on your exam, which will be tomorrow. And it'll be like the first one. It'll be online and engaged. We'll open up tomorrow morning at 8 a.m. It will remain open until 11:59 p.m. You'll get 30 multiple choice questions that will show up randomly, one at a time. You'll have two essays. But I'm going to warn you, this time around, I'm bringing the hammer. My last class, or my next class, 7 people I caught cheating on it. And I have the ability to see through Engage whether or not you switch screens. I also have the ability to use AI detection. And so half of the class are going to get zeros because it's a violation of the academic code of conduct. So my advice to you all is if you sit through class and you sleep, take the zero. Don't suspect that, well, not take the zero, but take the F. Don't make me suspect that you are cheating. Now, of course, out of fairness, I will give them all a chance to do a paper copy of the exam that I will monitor directly to see how efficient they are. And we'll see how they do. But chances are they won't do so swell. But you guys are the exception. You're a good class. I have nothing to worry about with you. All right. So, also, the other thing is, right after you guys left, I found the cord. The cord was actually hanging down on the bottom, so we could have used the stupid TV the other day, but it is what it is. So, we left off talking about the fact that England wanted to get into the mercantilist game. Why? Well, because Henry VII wanted more, more, more. So, he used the system that other monarchs were using, charters. And he granted a charter to, well, John Cabot in English. That's his Italian name, his actual name, Giovanni Caboto. And Cabot got the commission to go to China to plant the flag, to build trade, so that way the English could get more and more and more. And he proposed going north, because again, earth round, towards the top, it's narrowest. But of course we know he didn't get there, but he discovered something that he called Newfoundland. He had 3 expeditions. The first one failed. Don't know what happened on the third. But inspired by Caboto, in England, because there was more private property rights, unlike what was going on in Spain and Portugal, 2 nobles, English nobles, funded their own expeditions, went across, Weston and Elliot. Western, as we mentioned, reported the possibility of finding what he called a Northwest Passage. You know, a way to get around whatever this Newfoundland was to get to China. And then Hugh Elliot discovered what he called the Island of New Finding. Island of New Finding. So they knew there was something there. They just didn't know what it was. And it also did not match the descriptions of Marco Polo and other early explorers that traveled on the Silk Road of what Asia was supposed to look like. So, that brings us to what I wish I got to last class, but I ran out of time. Henry VII would give a charter, one last charter, to Sebastian Cabot, John Cabot's son, Sebastiano Caboto. We know from the records that Cabot made 2 trips, but there's no record of his first trip that survives detailing what he saw. But there is enough evidence to suggest that he brought back with him a whole bunch of salted cod. And cod was valuable because the English, you know, had long ate fish. It was a staple of their diet. So the fact that he was able to fish, capture cod, meant there was a commodity of value, money. There was something that could be made. On his second trip, which is the one he's best known for, because the full record in detail survived, he sailed south and basically went along almost the entire North American coast, all the way down from the Chesapeake Bay in modern North Carolina,
all the way up into Hudson Bay.
And the map
that he drew was fairly accurate. And one of the details he put on there was Little Cape Cod.
So by this expedition, in England, 1608, while Columbus is still alive in Spain, absolutely convinced he found China, the English start saying, maybe not. Maybe not. Maybe Amerigo Vespucci was right, that this was Mundus Novus, a new world. But, unfortunately, by the time Sebastian returned to England in April 1509, he learned that Henry VII died. So when one king dies, the next king rises. Henry VII was succeeded by his second son, Henry, who would be known to history as Henry VIII, and who coincidentally is one of the most famous monarchs in world history, and we will talk a little bit about him when we do the Protestant Reformation. Because, after all, the guy had six wives and he killed three of them. Well, it turns out Henry VIII had little interest in the pursuits of his father. He wasn't interested in the more. He wasn't interested in the explorations. Partly because he was really focused on the one thing that was important to him, continuing the dynasty, having a male heir. Partly because he kind of went to war with the Catholic Church. Partly because he was fighting a war with France. You know, he had a lot on his plate. But beginning with Henry VIII, his next two children also had little interest in more. Conquering land takes money, takes resources. And if there are no such resources present, or little, it's a lot to ask to invest when there's no promise of a return. So instead, what his son Edward, and then his daughter Mary did, was focused on making money off of the exchange that was going on. A lot of money was to be had interloping. Interloping is like cutting in. So, because the English ships were smaller but faster, what English merchants began doing is finding the supplies that the Portuguese in Brazil or the Spanish in their New World Empire wanted and getting them there quicker. They also literally engaged in piracy. Why? Well, you got this big wooden box that's in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean with no GPS, no sat phones, no way to communicate. So the English would just sail up, basically kill the crew, take the ship, and sail it back to London. And they also cut into the transatlantic slave trade. Why? Money. Money. All right. But things changed under the reign of Henry's second daughter, Elizabeth, who, FYI, that's not your class, who, FYI, even today is regarded as one of England's greatest rulers ever. Aiden is here. Sorry, don't mind me. Jake's here. Just want to make sure I don't miss anybody. Alec Rich is not here. Cool. All right. What happened during the reign of Elizabeth I? Well, Elizabeth decided to possibly reconsider the policies of her grandfather,
the more. She becomes monarch in the 1570s. And by the 1570s, Spain has already conquered the Aztec and the Inca empires. They have dominion, for the most part, over the Caribbean. They're starting to expand into North America. And they are generating tremendous wealth. And Portugal, with their system, is kind of at the height as well, before it begins a sudden decline. So she's hearing from her ambassadors of the tremendous wealth that is to be had if you're willing to start colonies. But the problem is, as we're going to see, she was also embroiled in some big political issues. There were multiple assassination attempts at her, there was an attempted coup, and there was the threatened invasion by Spain. So, she was hesitant. Plus, where are we going to go? You can't go south, because that's Portugal's. You know, you can't go down around South America, because that's Spain. So that meant the only possible route was basically going back to John Cabot. We're going to go in a northerly direction where the globe is the smallest and hope we come out in China. But the debate was going on. Do we go northeast, which would bring us in contact with Russia, or do we go northwest? Now, by the way, interestingly enough, this is a modern rendition with the Arctic Ocean being frozen. There is no evidence that there was a North Pole ice cap as big as it is now. It was starting to grow, so it was possible to actually go around the continents by sea. But here's the problem. You go northeast, you hit Russia. Not a good idea. You go northwest, you don't know what's there. So which is a better option? Well, a member of Parliament, Sir Humphrey Gilbert, decides to make the decision for the nation. He would receive a charter from Elizabeth, a blessing to go, but the crown would not pay. So he could fly under the English flag. Any land that he claimed for the crown would be England's. But he got all the profit. So 1583, he sets sail. He decides he's going to, looking at the records of what took place during the reign of Henry VII, he's going to go back and he's going to find that Newfoundland and see if there's anything valuable there. Sails across the Atlantic Ocean using the metrics, the angles that were recorded by his predecessors, crosses the Atlantic and lands up in Newfoundland. But lo and behold, when he arrives, down here, this little red dot that says St. John's, much to his shock when he arrived, there actually was a small colony there that was called St. John's. Unbeknownst to anybody, once word of these lands spread, and once the records of fish were spread, going back to Henry VII's reign, independent fishermen from Portugal, from France, from Spain, from Ireland, even from England, not telling anybody where they were going, sailed out into the Atlantic to go fishing. And they would make their way all the way across the Atlantic. And they would shack up at St. John's. St. John's was made not by a government, but by these fishermen. They had structures there where the crews could get shelter. They had tools there that if they needed to, they could cut down timber to make repairs to the boats. But they also had big racks in place because there was no refrigeration. So if you fished, the only way to preserve it was to basically skin it, cut it open, let it dry out with salt, and make it into like a beef jerky. Oh, that was cod jerky, fish jerky. That was a way to preserve it. So, salted cod was a very popular luxury item. So there was money to be made. Well, apparently Gilbert freaks out and says, "You have no right to be here. This was claimed by England." And he takes control of St. John's in the name of his queen. He also continues to... Oh, by the way, one other thing. He was the person who named the New World English possessions Virginia, in celebration of the Virgin Queen. He also started sailing around in the waters out and around Newfoundland. And he discovered the Grand Banks. He claimed that in this part of the North Atlantic, which is still one of the primary fisheries to this day, most of the fish that you get, if you get fish at any fish store, fish and chips time is coming up, comes from the Grand Banks. Gilbert described the part of the water as being so plentiful with fish that a man could jump overboard and walk all the way to land on the backs of the fish. Something of value. If you're going to make an investment and get more and more and more, you have to get something of value. And he discovered something that the English could make money on. Unfortunately, after making all his discoveries, he ran low on supplies and decided to sail back to England. But on his return, his little expedition of three ships gets caught in a North Atlantic storm, and his command ship, which happened to be the smallest of the three ships, a book called The Squirrel, did a k. Got hit by a real bad tidal wave, and the main support beam cracked, splintered, and began to sink. But Gilbert, being the captain, ordered his crew to disembark, and he would go down with the ship. Well, he was last seen on the deck, tying himself to one of the rails while holding in one of his hands a copy of Utopia, a book by Sir Thomas More. But his crew returned, shared the details of the stories, and that inspired the imaginations of the English. It's worth it. The risk is worth it. We are going to be able to make money with the New World. Well, Gilbert's half-brother, Sir Walter Raleigh, was the man who then took up the mantle. excuse me. Getting for England more and more and more. Raleigh was an action hero. He was a swashbuckling adventurer. He fought in the French Wars of Religion that we're going to talk about. He was involved in a violent suppression of an Irish rebellion. He was a pirate. And he happened to be a favorite of the Queen. He was a stud. So, in one meeting, he presented Gilbert's findings to Elizabeth and basically says, "I want to get a colony for you. So that way England can make money off the New World." And after consideration, Elizabeth gives him a charter. But the terms are important. Term number one. He is to explore Virginia. Term number one. He has to explore Virginia. With the intent of two, colonizing Virginia. Explore and colonize. But here's the catch. The colonies must only be in, and I quote, the remote, heathen, and barbarous lands, not actually possessed by any Christian prince, nor inhabited by Christian people. Elizabeth didn't want to start a war. They wanted a colony. They wanted to make money. But they were not going to fight the Spanish. In particular. Alright. What happens if Raleigh is successful? Here's term number three. Raleigh would personally receive 20% of any gold or silver that was found. So you're going to explore and colonize lands not held by Christians. And Raleigh would personally receive 20%. 20% would go to the crown. And the remaining 60% would go to the crew. And last but not least, he had 7 years to do it. Elizabeth would grant him a monopoly. She would not allow any other English explorers to do this. He had 7 years to do it. Do I need to repeat any of those? All right. Well, why? Well, again, Elizabeth wanted money, and Elizabeth wanted a base of operations because she was continuing the practice of her father, her brother, and her sister. She also was giving licenses to privateers, pirates. So in her mind, if there's a colony over there, all of the pirates, English pirates, sailing on the Atlantic Ocean could have a base to go to, a safe haven. All right, Raleigh would send forth three expeditions. The first was an expedition to gather some more information on Virginia. He decides to sail much farther. Gilbert was only up in Newfoundland, up here. But Raleigh was inspired by the records of Sebastian Cabot, and he sailed almost the entire way down the Atlantic coast, down believed to be possibly as south as Georgia, which of course was Spanish territory. But on his expeditions, he made note of the Chesapeake Bay. The Chesapeake Bay down in North Carolina is a massive inlet that allows modern ocean-going vessels to basically sail inland, protected from the ocean storms. So, he thought this would be a great location for this colony. Then he would send an expedition whose goal was to actually set up a colony. And they came into here, this part of the Chesapeake Bay, Albemarle Sound, sailing into the interior. They made note of Roanoke Island, which was a large island, had fresh water. thought this would be a great place for a base because you're not on the mainland, so if there are any Christians there, you don't have to worry about fighting with them. And this barrier protects it from the ocean storms. The colonists, however, did not engage in smart behavior. Once they arrived and set up a primitive camp, they, fascinated by the stories of the gold and the silver that the Spanish were getting out of the New World, would spend all of their time roaming the region looking for gold and silver instead of fixing their shelters, instead of trying to find food sources. To make matters worse, when they actually did penetrate the land, they came in contact with natives who were not overly pleased at the presence of these colonists. So, when one of the first pirate ships, commanded by Sir Francis Drake, who was returning after robbing Spanish galleons of their gold, landed in Roanoke to get resupplied, all of the colonists were like, get us out of here. So he collected them all and sailed them back to England. Failure. But if at first you don't succeed, try again. So it would be Raleigh's third expedition that would become infamous. Because this time he wasn't going to just simply make a little base of operations. Instead, he was intending to actually build a community, which he called Raleigh City. The intent was not to build it out on Roanoke Island, but rather to bring it inland. And what this is showing is the original intended location on the interior. But in order for it not to be discovered, he actually wrote the location in invisible link that in modern scientists used and x-rayed it. And they actually found where the intended location was. But to make sure this would work, he did something that the Spanish had not done initially, nor the Portuguese. Instead of just sending men amongst the 118 colonists were 17 women and 9 children. Why women and children? Why not just dudes? Yeah, you could have population increase. Well, I don't want to be offensive to anybody, but as a married man, I can tell you, I am a hell of a lot different than I was when I was single. Because my wife has a way of not only telling me how I'm wrong on everything, but also a way to motivate me to do things that are responsible. To not run around throughout the wilderness looking for gold and silver. No, make sure that the roof is sound. It's not leaking. Make sure that there's food. Make sure, you know, that the house is defended. Things like that. Raleigh realized instead of a bunch of guys going off half-cocked by sending family units, the focus is going to be actually how to protect and build the colony, as opposed to wild goose chases. And FYI, one of the women was pregnant and would give birth to the first English citizen in the New World, a baby girl who would be named Virginia Dare. She also happened to be the granddaughter of the group's leader, a man by the name of John White. Well, after several weeks that included skirmishes with the native tribes, instead of going to their intended location, they decided to set upon a location that was closer to the coast to build a temporary base. Because the plan was to send the ships back to England, get more men, get more women, get more supplies, to build up the population to be able to fight back. In August, after setting up shop for 2 months, John White gets back on the ships, sails back to England to negotiate, to get more supplies, get more people. But unfortunately, when he returned in 1587, in November, England was in a state of war with Spain. We will see why. But with the threat of Spanish invasion, Elizabeth ordered all ships to be seized by the crown for use in defense of the islands. So this meant that John White was not able to return to the colonists for 3 years. He would set sail in the summer of 1590, arrive in the New World by August. First, they search Roanoke Island. That was to be the retreat point in case of emergency. They found nothing. Then they went further into the interior to where the temporary colony had been built. As they sailed up, one of the dinghies was there. The palisade, the wall, was still there, but there was no one on guard. So he departed and went up, and the gate was wide open. They quickly searched, and they discovered that the houses had all been dismantled, taken apart, but all stacked up neatly, like they were going to be transported. So they weren't broken, they weren't burned. There were no personal possessions left. No clothes, no pots, no jewelry. There was no record of where they had gone. There were no graves. There was no sign of struggle. The only thing what they found carved into one of the posts near the gate was the word Croatoan. Croatoan was the Indian name for Roanoke Island. Croatoan was also the name for the kingdom of the Indians that was around where the colony was. Croatoan was also the name of the people who controlled the territory around them. And Croatoan was also the name of the Indian chieftain, as interpreted by the English. But what does this mean? Does this mean the Croatoans came to kill them? Does this mean they moved to Roanoke Island? But there was no sign of them there. Does this mean that the Croatoans came and captured them all, enslaved them, killed them, dumped their bodies into the water, or ate them? Were they cannibals? Don't know. To this day, there is no actual evidence that is clear that shows what happened to the colonists. They were just lost. Now, of course, if you're into conspiracy theories, there are lots of them surrounding what happened to the people. But again, no actual hardcore evidence. I'll just give you one. Apparently, about 20 years later, when the English actually came and established Jamestown, some of the Jamestown colonists came across a local tribe that had an amazing amount of Indians that were blonde and blue-eyed. But again, they didn't have pictures. Was it just an imaginary story? Don't know. So long story short, Raleigh did not get his 25% or 20% of gold and silver because nothing of value occurred. And after the failure of Raleigh City, Elizabeth lost interest in more. It wasn't worth it. But when Elizabeth died in 1603, as we will see, she was succeeded by her cousin, James. And James was completely interested in more. But in a different way. Because by the time of the reign of James I in England, private enterprises were being established. When people would buy stocks, private citizens, and get a percentage of the profits by these companies. So these joint stock trading companies would pick up the risk of going across the Atlantic and making colonies, not the crown. Now, the only catch was the crown still had to give them the right, because again, Virginia was claimed in the name of the crown. So if you wanted to go get a colony, you had to go to the crown and get a charter, his permission. That charter had the terms of mercantilism in it. So any colonists, they're still subjects of the government. They're expected to produce things that are good for the empire's economy. They're going to be subject to regulation, taxation, all that stuff. And by the way, whereas the private ventures of Raleigh and others failed, and by the way, there would be two other colonies that were just so small, one of them up in Maine, that I just don't have time to talk about. It would be during the reign of James where these private ventures actually started getting success. Because they were not motivated because of politics. They were motivated for profit. The two that started it all off, that managed to actually survive and generate profit for their companies, was Jamestown, which was founded in modern Virginia in 1607, and that place down, you know, south of Boston, Plymouth. And it's 1620, not 162. That typo's been on this for like 4 years, and every time I see it, I'm going to fix it. Obviously, I haven't. Because you know what's going to happen? I'm going to completely forget about it the moment I go like this. Now, by the way, there's a lot of misnomers about Plymouth in particular. Were there a bunch of people coming over here for religious freedom? No. What they were doing is they were coming over to establish a religious community, where they made the rules of religion, and the only people allowed to live in the colony had to follow their religion. But how did they afford to come over here? Well, simple. They got a charter from the company called the Plymouth Company. And the Plymouth Company basically hired the ships, paid for all the supplies, and under the terms of the charter, the company would own Plymouth Colony. And all of the people that went to the colony were essentially employees for the company. And they had a responsibility to grow stuff, harvest stuff, produce stuff that were of value. By the way, the terms were the same with Jamestown. The company owns the land, you're an employee of the company. The company will give you a grant so you can take possession of part of the land, grow something that's valuable. Both of these were like Roanoke. Men and women came, as well as children, because the intent was to plant communities. Different than what the Spanish were doing, different than the Portuguese, different than even the French, who we're going to talk about in a few minutes. Now, in both, you had one of two status levels. You either paid your own way over, or someone paid your way over. If you paid your own way over, you were considered a free man. And you would be basically like a full-blown employee of the company. If, however, you didn't have the money and someone had to pay your way over, you would basically sell yourself to one of the freemen. And you'd have to work on the freeman's farm for a period of years. Anywhere between 5 to 10 years. And then once you fulfilled your terms, you would be released. You'd contact the company and the company would give you a plot of land. And then you could go to business for yourself. And yes, women came over in high numbers because of what someone said earlier. The English recognized that the only way to get these colonies growing was to allow for natural multiplication. I hate to break it to you. Men don't have babies. And you don't get babies when it's a man and a man or a woman and a woman. The only way to get babies and grow the population is to allow the man and the women to do the things that Mother Nature intended them to do. Well, as a result, unlike all of the other colonies, by the Spanish, the Portuguese, the French, the English was the only one that was growing naturally. FYI. By 1630, there were three colonies over here in the New World that had a population total of about 10,000. But by 1763, there were 14 colonies over here with a population of 3 million. Unlike the Spanish colonies, the viceroyalities, the gubernaciones, calabritos, unlike those, the colonies over here were semi-autonomous. There was no Council of Indies that appointed governors to make decisions in the crown. No, what ended up happening over here is the colonists elected local assemblies. They made their own local governments, and they voted on laws for the colony. And while they were still part of the English Empire for the most part, the crown just basically let them do their own thing. And these assemblies made laws that applied to everybody equally. One of the most bizarre elements that makes what we became exceptional was the fact that there was no nobility over here. Any person brave enough to get on a boat and come across the seas and work their butts off could become fabulously rich. But you didn't have any more rights or privileges than the poorest person. Because they had rules that were put in place. They had their own versions of like constitutions. They brought over English common law, so the law was applied to everybody. And all freemen, and even indentured servants, were entitled to certain rights and privileges. And of course, it would be out of these seeds that America would be born. And it also explains why America is so different than everywhere else on Earth today. Questions? So of course, the greatest irony is these colonists came over to do more and more and more for England, but we got so much more and more and more, we broke away and did it ourselves. The last mercantile empire that we're going to talk about is what the French did. The Portuguese went out first, then came the Spanish, and shortly after the Spanish came the English, but the English stopped for a whole bunch of time. But once the English started going, the French would make their way across the sea. Now, unlike what motivated Henry VII, which of course was, you know, getting around the southern tip of Africa and also Columbus's expedition, what motivated the French was Magellan's return. In the stories, the fact that the globe was huge and that North and South America were in fact the New World. So seeing all the land that was there, the King of France in 1522, Francis I, decides, you know something? I want more, more, more. So just like Ferdinand and Isabella and John I and Henry VII, King Francis would give a commission to an Italian ship captain, Giovanni de Varanzo. Knowing at this point Henry VIII was not sending anybody over to Newfoundland, Francis basically says, you know something? I hate Henry. I hate those English. And they're not paying attention. Let's see if we can scoop it up on them. So Varanzo set sails for Newfoundland, which technically was claimed by England. But Varanzo was blown off course, and instead of ending up in Newfoundland, he actually ended up down in North Carolina near Cape Fear. You know, that kind of happens when you're out in the middle of the ocean and you don't have a compass. You don't have, you know, GPS. But he did manage to cross the Atlantic Ocean, and he slowly made his way up the coast, making note of different potential inlets that fabled Northwest Passage, including going up to the Sagadahoc River up in Maine. Sailed through Narragansett Bay, described Block Island in
Martha's Vineyard.
Apparently went up Hudson River too, making note of New York Bay. But it would take a decade before the French would send somebody else. Why? Well, like I said, England and France would almost kind of go to war. So, you know, Francis was busy dealing with Henry, and he had his own problems. But once those were settled in 1534, Francis would give commission to Jacques Cartier. His mission? Get around this. Find a way through it. Because what are all these early expeditions recording? Lots of land, lots of trees, no city, no gold. So in 1534, Cartier sails across the Atlantic and penetrates the waterway. The green is his first expedition. The waterway in behind Newfoundland. Today it's the Gulf of St. Lawrence. And he made reference to Prince Edward Island, of course the Gaspé Peninsula, all of this stuff. He recorded its location. But to make sure the English would get the message, he also planted a 10-meter tall, 30 feet tall cross in the ground, bearing the words in French, "Long live the King of France." In 1535, he would set sail for a second expedition. The focus of this trip, let's see where this leads. He would sail across the Atlantic Ocean and penetrate the St. Lawrence River, hoping that this would be the fabled Northwest Passage. He arrived on October 2nd and began sailing up the river. He would actually sail so far inland, he came in contact with Stadacona, which was the capital of the Iroquois people. And apparently, he got along pretty well with the Iroquois chief, a man by the name of Donnacona. So much so that the Iroquois basically told the French, look, it's going to get cold. The river's going to freeze. Your ships are going to get stuck. So the Iroquois convinced Cartier and his crew to actually spend the winter with them. They established good relations, which of course ultimately allowed his men to survive the harsh winter. Once the spring set in and all of the ice melted, they got back on their ship and sailed back to France. And then 5 years later, they would come back for a third time with the intent of planting a colony. Why? Well, Francis wanted the French to be able to exploit the wealth of the New World. More. Cartier would bring with him multiple ships, plus 100 men who were going to serve as colonists. But they would find nothing of value. They would do some mining,
They actually extracted two entire shiploads of pyrite. Anyone know what pyrite is? P-Y-R-I-T-E, pyrite? Pyrite's fool's gold. Looks like gold. Pull it out of the rocks, it's gold, it's shiny. But what ends up happening is when you mix chemicals with it, it basically turns to liquid, unlike gold, which does not. So they spent a whole winter digging out this useless stuff. To make matters worse, apparently they brought with them influenza and smallpox, and there was an outbreak amongst the Iroquois people, to which they traced to the presence of the French. So they began attacking the colony. At which point, Cartier and the crew would get back on their ships and sail back to France. Well, after this failure, Francis basically decided this more thing isn't worth the expense. It's not worth the headache because there's nothing of value in North America. Well, from 1534 all the way up until 1600, France also had problems, similar to what took place in England during the Tudor period. The most significant thing, as we're going to see, there would be about a 50-year span when France was engaged in a series of religious wars. And they literally were killing themselves over which church people went to. Well, the winner of the wars of religion was Henri IV. Once he brought peace to France, 1601, again, after seeing how much wealth Spain extracted over those 100-odd years, the English, the Dutch are starting to follow the Portuguese into Asia. Money is being generated. He decides, you know, I think I want to get into the more game. So he would commission a Frenchman, Samuel de Champlain, who would come over and would basically give to the France a colony to help them build up their mercantilist empire. Now, Champlain was a superstar. He had sailed across the Atlantic with his uncle multiple times. He went to the Spanish New World. He actually went into Mexico City. He visited the Caribbean islands. He saw with his own eyes how much money was being generated by the Spanish. So, when he received the commission, he's like, you know something? The potential's there. We can make money, which can be taxed for the crown. But, before coming over, he would spend 3 years gathering all of the data that he could gather about all of the trips by both England and France that went to the New World. He also visited the ports. He started talking to fishermen who had been coming over, technically illegally. He wanted to know all he could about the New World. And then, once he learned a lot, he actually came over with fishermen and fur trappers who had been coming over
in touching base along the coast. FYI, do you want to know why Plymouth was not wiped out? Plymouth Colony? Because all of these fishermen and fur trappers that had been coming over had come in contact with the native tribes, even in Massachusetts, and brought with them the smallpox and the flu and the disease. So, but for those expeditions, there's no way the English could have started Plymouth, because the North American tribes were as decimated as the Central and Southern American tribes. But you don't learn about that in history books. Well, you could if you get the right books. It's possible he brought disease with him too. You never know. But he came over, he checked out the coast again. You can see the green where he came over on one trip, the red, went down to Cape Cod. He traveled, checked everything out, trying to find the ideal spot. And then when he was ready to go in 1608, he came across with his own crew, sailed down the St. Lawrence River, and would found a colony which he called the Habitation. The Habitation was located a few miles south of the Iroquois capital. But it was located at a place that the Indians call Quebec. Quebec is Algonquin for where the river narrows. If you've ever sailed on the St. Lawrence, when you sail to about where Quebec is, the river gets really, really narrow. And most modern ships, although they've dredged it and they've made canals, but pretty much it gets really difficult to begin traveling going down to Lake Ontario. The purpose of the Habitation? To be a trading post. So the idea was is to have fur trappers and explorers live in Quebec, use this as a base of operations, make friends with the Indians, and start doing business with them. He would spend the next 25 years in the New World. After founding Quebec, he would travel further south down the St. Lawrence and would find, in 1611, the city of Montreal. The following year, he would sail back to France and petition the new king, the son of Henri IV, Louis XIII, to proclaim this region to be a royal colony, which would get the name New France. Unlike what the English did, where there were local governments, local assemblies, New France would have a top-down government, like Spain. So the king basically owned all the land, and then there would be a governor that was in New France. And Champlain would be the first governor until his death in 1632. And finally, he didn't just sit back, he continued to explore. He would be one of the first Europeans to penetrate the interior and see the Great Lakes with his own eyes, claiming them for France. Thus, in the years before Plymouth exploded, the French were there. But unlike what the English did, there would be little natural multiplication in New France. at its height in and around 1740, after the French discovered New Orleans, sailed up and down the Mississippi, claimed all of the interior for France, there were very few actual towns like what were being built in the British colonies. What there were a series of trading posts. So it was possible to go from point to point to point to point to point. And these trading posts would be like military forts. They would be guarded by French soldiers. And the Indians from the area would go and trade with French merchants. But there were few French women. So, while in the English colonies the population would grow into the millions, the French population over this vast domain was minuscule, numbering only in the tens of thousands. Why? Well, the French, I don't want to say it was illegal for women to come over, but women were not encouraged to come over. So who was over here? Men who were soldiers, who were trappers. There were some Jesuit priests that came over. But because they were there to do business, not build homes, not build communities, the French, amazingly, were able to maintain good relations with the Indians. They befriended the Indians. They lived with the Indians. They learned from the Indians. And when it got cold, the French would do some snuggles under the fur blankets with the Indian women as well. But the French also tried bringing Christ to the Indians. And there were some conversions. But the most important thing that the Jesuit priests did is they recorded the stories of the Indian people that they came in contact with. And had not the French done so, a lot of our knowledge of what the tribes were like as the colonies were growing in North America would have been lost, because there was no tribe in North America that had writing. Everything was done orally. So all of their stories would have been lost. And because they were friends, that's one of the reasons why they were able to spread out so far. Because the Indian tribes and chiefs willingly would allow the French to come up and build up a new trading post for the opportunity to do business. And that's pretty much where I'm going to leave it, I guess. I thought I had one more click, but I guess I don't. So with this, we've dealt with the Renaissance and the Age of Exploration. We've covered four of the major Western civilization mercantilist empires. We've given you all kind of little facts and details. That will be on your exam, for those of you who came late, which will open up in the computer system tomorrow. It will open up at 8 a.m. It will remain open all day, all the way till 11:59 p.m. So at some point, give me an hour. And for those of you who came late, I'm going to share the same warning I gave to those who were here on time. My class that comes in next, I caught half of the class cheating. I did a deep dive with the analytics in Engage. They were using AI on their essays, and they were switching screens. So, I trust this group will not do that. Because again, you're all supposed to be operating under the academic honesty policy. So if you use your own notes that you took in class, I'm okay with that. But if you use other sources, I will know. And so what's going to be the penalty for them? Well, they're going to get zeros on their exams. Don't want to have to do the same to you. So do this honestly. And if that means you end up with a D, better a D than a zero. Just saying. All right? Do your exam tomorrow. I'll see you on Wednesday. No.
Thursday.
Thank you.